From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning, focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful, very warm day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour, and we are pleased and honored to have Deacon Sergio Diaz join us. I started to give your name. I go, no, if you're a deacon, it's like if you're a priest
thank
or
you
you're a bishop.
Much.
I'm not just going to
no,
use
I'm
your
a deacon.
Your first name is now Deacon.
Thank you.
Who was a deacon? He played for the Rams. Deacon, I think it was Jones, played for the Los Angeles Rams.
Oh, okay.
But that was just his first name.
Oh, it was.
Some people are smart. They name their kids Dean or Deacon or Major. Yeah, Deacon Jones, Gabe, our producer, he's the football guy. So, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Good to have you with us. One of the reasons we're having you, we should have had you on a long time ago, is the Red Mass is coming up on October the 1st, Tuesday. It's a mass for attorneys, legislators, everybody really, but and it will take place at the Cathedral of the Blessed Sacrament. Father Michael Sweeney will be the concelebrant with Bishop Soto, and he will be the guest homilist. And then following that is a dinner at the Sutter Club, where you will be presented with the St. Thomas More Award.
Yes, I
will. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's a great, great honor. I was very surprised because from past awardees, I know that it's a very prestigious award, and I'm sure that this year they also had very strong candidates. So I'm not sure how I ended up with this award, but here I am.
I looked at, I've been to many of these dinners, and I've seen the past recipients. And just to get through their all the things they've done takes about 20 minutes. And so it is. It's a little bit like being in Cooperstown in the Baseball Hall of Fame. You know, you're humbled because look at these names around me, and there are some wonderful people on that
there
list.
There are, and some of them are my friends, and I admire. I don't have those sort of accomplishments, and I'm grateful to know them, and some of them to know them well, and I've admired them for a long time, not just professionally, but I think more personally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell us first off about the diaconate and what drew you to that, to become a deacon, and when that was.
Well, that was sort of by default. In that, let's see, approximately 10, 11 years ago, a number of persons, I like to go, I attend daily mass. So friends and acquaintances, priests, other deacons at that time, they were mentioning to me, well, have you ever thought of the diaconate? And I frankly responded, no, it wasn't really something that I was aspiring to. When I was in school, I never thought about being a priest or anything like that. So then I had a conversation with my wife, and I said, you know, why does this keep coming up? Why are persons mentioning this? So as a matter of just putting this to rest, I thought, I'll look into it and then determine if this is for me or not. But at least I will have looked into it, and it won't be this lingering question in my mind. Well, God has a very interesting way of having everything fit together. My wife went on a retreat to, Massachusetts, and she happened to meet, and I didn't realize who that person was, the nun, the religious who was in charge of the diaconate at that time. And then
From the Diocese of Sacramento.
From the Diocese.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And then she said, would you like to meet the sister that I met? And I said, sure, we'll go to lunch. And then, so we had lunch, and I learned about a little bit about this religious sister, and that she had a prominent position here. And then, but I still wasn't quite sure what she was doing. And it was more of just a thank you gift to her for having been kind to my wife during the retreat there in Massachusetts. Anyway, after all of that, I said to my wife, well, I think I should probably go and look into it. Well, I didn't realize that was the sister that was in charge of the diaconate. And when I came to look into it here, I think at the diocese, the application process was closing in a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you know, this application process has been going on for about a year. Why did you wait so long? Well, I wasn't really thinking about this. And then all of a sudden I found myself in the diaconate and
wow.
went forward. And
this is a 4 or 5 year formation program?
Yes. And honestly, I kept thinking during that formation period, I thought, Lord, I've looked into this. If this isn't for me, it's okay. You know, it's, I mean, as you get closer to ordination, you start wanting to be ordained. But I really was thinking, if it's not for me, there's a lot of other ways of serving.
Sure.
So here I am.
So what's your home parish?
Sacred Heart.
Sacred Heart. Are you assigned there or are you assigned someplace else?
I'm assigned to Sacred Heart. And I serve as other deacons. I help with the mass, baptisms, baptism class, funerals when that comes up. But honestly, the I would say 80% of my ministry has been and is outside the parish.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel moved in other directions, and that's I've been grateful. I'm grateful that both the bishop and the pastors have allowed me to serve in other areas.
Did you grow up in Sacramento?
I did. My mom and I immigrated to this country. I was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm. From?
From Mexico.
From Mexico.
And the reason being is because my dad abandoned us when I was 4.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom, I think, thought, or she was hoping for some kind of reconciliation here. But in fact, my dad already had another family with children, so that was never going to come about. So the only thing that did come about, and I'm very grateful for, is I have a brother, and there's 10 years difference between us. And he and I are close, even though he works in the East Coast and I'm here. And then because we really didn't have any place to live, we came to live with my aunt here. Mm-hmm. And they worked at the canneries, and they had a small house, 4 children, 2 women unmarried, mm-hmm. 1 divorced. And thankfully, they took us in. Otherwise, we would have been homeless. So, and then my mom, she sacrificed a lot so that I could, both my brother and I, go to Catholic school. And I think that was really what was critical to her, that we receive an education. So I went to Christian Brothers, I went to Davis, I went to Loyola, Davis University, Loyola right. in Los Angeles, and here I am.
So we got a couple of Aggies in this room.
Yes, right, a couple of Aggies. Uh-huh.
Which means we got dirt between our boots.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
Know how to drive a tractor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So looking at all the discussion of immigration today,
mm-hmm.
you are an immigrant.
I am.
What was your path like?
Well, immigrating was much easier before. And the animus that exists now toward immigrants was not present before.
No, I wholeheartedly agree with that. It just wasn't there.
And now it's become political fodder.
Sure.
And I think it's used to incite people to, you know, to use immigrants as a scapegoat
right.
for the problems, economic, social, whatever. In one of my ministries, I've tried to serve that community, and I hope to, in the future, to do even more so. Because what I've seen, at least from my own experience, is that immigrants take the lowest paying jobs. They're willing to work any conditions, as my mom did. I mean, she worked in a fast food restaurant. We didn't have a car. There was really no time set because she would go in the afternoon, I think 2 or 3, and whenever that fast food place closed, 1 or 2 in the morning, and then she cleaned up afterwards, she would run home.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen how immigrants are exploited.
And they're not going to make waves.
They're not. They're afraid. I mean,
whether it's a workman's comp issue or a wage issue, they're not going to make waves.
You know, and there's too much at stake. And I think that mostly is that whatever people think of immigrants, they have children and they have loved ones, and they're not going to jeopardize their status here, whether it's lawful or not, for speaking up even when they're entitled to, because that can turn into the boss can say, well, I'm going to report you. I'm going to, you're not working here anymore. All kinds of things, right? And that will not just have adverse consequence to them, but to their children at home. For a while, I was volunteer at Cristo Rey High School. Mm-hmm. And a number of the kids, their parents are in that unlawful status situation. So I never experienced this, but to see kids fearful that they might be going home and not finding their parents there. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, to live with that kind of uncertainty. And then I also, through other volunteer work, met some of the dreamers and all of that.
Right.
And, I mean, people who have really excelled, you know, and to be maligned and to be thought of as that they're getting a free ride here or something, I mean, that's just, that's not right.
Well, it's what we've always talked about as the American dream. Mm-hmm. You come here now, there's some discussion of somebody says we need to change what's on the Statue of Liberty. Uh-huh. You need to be self-sufficient when you come here. But which is, I don't know very many of us, even those of us who were native-born, who were self-sufficient from day one. Many of us, needed help.
And you know, you look at the tax code, for example, it's weighted heavily in the favor of those persons who have means, who have a business, who earn money through capital gains, okay, who have the connections to get government contracts. And to say that those persons are not getting a helping hand, and a significant helping hand from the powers that be, because they contribute heavily to the politicians, they're connected with lobbyists and all of that. You know, to say that the playing ground is equal, it's not. Yeah. You know, and the person who works as a gardener or who's working at a restaurant and getting paid minimum wage, if they are getting paid minimum wage and not totally being exploited, you know, and to say, well, that person's really taking jobs away. They're not taking jobs away from anybody. My neighbor is a commercial landscaper. And the only persons that are willing to work those hours, those conditions for that pay is Hispanics.
Yeah.
And we're good friends. We've been good friends for 30 years. He says the other people just don't last. You know, they say, this is not for me.
Well, we've seen that in the agriculture industry for sure. Uh-huh. I remember, I don't know if it was in California, I think it was California, it was Lake County, and the pears were rotten on the ground. Right. And they said, no, we're only going to hire, you got to have everything in order. They got seven people, and they all quit after the first day.
My roommate in law school, I've never been this intimately aware of the farm worker lifestyle and the hardworking conditions in which they have to exist. And he invited me home to meet his family in the Bakersfield area, Lamont. Mm-hmm. And I remember that seeing his brothers and sisters, he was the only fortunate one to have received an education. And seeing his brothers and sisters come in covered with dirt from the top of their head down to their shoes, and then learning that that work that they did was not only poorly paid, the conditions were extremely hard, but they didn't work all year. It was seasonal.
Right.
And they had to go around the state chasing crops or trying to figure out how they were going to make it to the next growing season. And I thought, you know, these are the people that are putting food on their table. And I can't think of anything that I would ever imagine that I would. All I can have is gratitude for them, you know, for the work that they're doing. And admiration for a heart, they struggle to provide food for their children and for themselves.
I was one of the lucky ones when I was growing up in Davis. I got to work with the Braceros, who came up. They came up legally. It was all men, of course, and I guess it started during World War II because there was a shortage of labor. And then they would go back to Mexico after the season. But and that was back before we had tomato harvesters. And all I can remember is picking the tomatoes. Well, it was kind of hard on your back, but it wasn't so much the picking them. It was carrying that lug box to the end of the row. And you'd get a punch on a, you had this ticket on you with 50 punches on it. You get a punch for every time, and you got 11 cents every time you did that.
11 cents.
And if you got a full 50 in a day, which would be, what, $5.50, you felt like you'd really, and it was, somebody would pick me up in a pickup truck. We'd go out halfway between Davis and Woodland at 6 in the morning, and they'd work till sundown. And then they would go back to these farm labor camps, and my dad would take me to Mass on Sunday evenings. Uh-huh. The local priest would go out to the farm labor camp and say, I want you to know how other people live. And the farm labor camps were, as you know, not it wasn't the Hilton.
No.
And yet these people, I wasn't one of them. They knew I wasn't one of them.
You were experiencing it.
And I was experiencing it. And the way they treated me was like royalty, and their work ethic was incredible.
You know, I when I was at Davis, they had a program. I think I just kind of fell into it to tutor migrant kids.
Uh-huh.
So these were the camps, the migrant camps in winters.
In winters, right?
So I went out there, and I thought I had stepped from the 20th century back into the 19th century.
Right.
And the homes in which they lived, which were not their own.
Right, right.
They were the owners.
The growers. Exactly.
And how sparsely they lived. And then I remember that I had the same feeling that I was an outsider who was interested in their lifestyle, and I was being treated like royalty. They couldn't do enough for me.
Right.
They gave me almonds. They fed me. So out of that, I said, well, how about your children? I can bring them to the university and show them what the university is like. And then they can come swimming in the place where I live with my roommates. So we did that. And what I started realizing is that these children were walking the same road that their parents had walked.
Right.
And they were likely going to end up in the same
exactly.
place.
Exactly, exactly.
And when I took him into this other environment, not only were they so overwhelmed and all of that, you know, with the pool, it was warm in the summer, but it was just, it was like they were experiencing a whole new different world. And it was probably only 20 miles from where they live.
Right.
But I started thinking, you know, why is it that I've been blessed the way I have? I mean, we grew up poor. My mom supported us through that job that she had at the first at the fast food place and then later Sacramento Bee. But these children were in a whole different world of poverty that I had no idea what it was like. And not only that, they were going to end up probably doing the same thing that their parents were doing.
Right.
Because of the lack of opportunities, because their parents could not provide them with anything more.
Sure.
And they had to help the family, to support the family when they're old enough. So,
Well, it's we're both blessed to have had those experiences. Because,
yes, I think so. Perspective.
It opens your eyes.
It does.
In a way, I remember I was a VISTA volunteer after graduating from Davis, which was sort of like the domestic Peace Corps. It was called Volunteers in Service to America, and I was living with an African-American family in the projects in Atlanta. And, of course, I went down there. I was going to save the world. I was going to end poverty overnight. And I was overwhelmed by how extensive it was.
Right.
You know, you go block after block after block, and there was so much poverty, and this is back in the 60s, and one little boy living there had a bad eye, and I said, what happened? And he said, oh, we got a screwdriver. They're fooling around, and a screwdriver went in his eye when he was 3 or 4 years old. And I said, well, what do the doctors say? She said, he's never been to a doctor, mm-hmm. which is just not in my world.
Yes. You know, inconceivable.
Yeah, inconceivable. So,
let's see. Last year I was in Honduras. My wife and I went to Honduras on a missionary trip. And prior to that, we had volunteered in the Tenderloin District with the Marinos.
San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that was an experience, but it wasn't, I didn't feel quite immersed into it mm-hmm. the same way. We were there for a week.
This was with the Marinol?
Yes, and mm-hmm. we were volunteering at the St. Anthony's Church or mm-hmm. St. Anthony's Parish there in Tenderloin. So you serve, you help at the food closet and all that. But at night we would go home mm-hmm. to where the other volunteers were. So it gave you some distance from, the whole experience. But when we were in Honduras, we were living, staying at the missionary's house, and he lives like the people he serves.
Right.
And each home we went to, we got to see the poverty really up close. And typically we would start our day at 7 in the morning and sometimes not finish until 8 or 9 at night. And that the poverty that I saw, it was much more difficult to put distance in between us and that poverty. Mm-hmm. Because I remember going into homes where they had dirt floors, somewhere in the mountains. The other times there were people that were just, like I remember a man who had lost his leg because of a snake, and he had a prosthesis, but that prosthesis must have been given to him or provided to him many years before because his leg had overgrown over the mm-hmm. prosthesis. There were children that I thought they were much younger than they were, but they were actually, they were malnourished. So they looked like 6 or 7, but they were actually 10 or 11.
Wow.
And besides that, I noticed the tension there, because there's violence there, right? And you might, we saw soldiers and police and all of that, but still there's a certain palpable fear there. And we were there when the caravans were getting organized to come here. And I thought, if anybody lived in these conditions, if anybody, for example, like you have a business, and this, we met a family, and somebody says to you, this is how much you have to pay, and, if you want to be safe.
Right.
And it's really being safe from the people who are extorting you.
Right.
And then later on they might say, well, we need a little bit more. Or we like your daughter, and she's going to be my girlfriend. And these are gang members, and... you live in neighborhoods where killings and kidnappings and all of that's going on. That's why people are coming here.
Right.
It's they had another choice. They wouldn't just venture out the way they're doing. So these aren't people here that are. I didn't really meet criminals or anything that were embarking on this long journey. They don't need to come here. They have it pretty good there. They kind of run the place
in
certain neighborhoods. Taxi drivers won't go into certain neighborhoods. They say, I'm not driving into that area. I'm not driving into that area because that's controlled by this gang or that gang. So seeing all of that and experiencing that, I think it helps to open your eyes, to see what's going on here from a different perspective and to discount some of the rhetoric that that I hear. And it's really kind of disgusting.
We're with Sergio Diaz, Deacon Sergio Diaz, who on October the 1st will be the recipient of the St. Thomas More Award at a dinner following the Red Mass. The Red Mass, Tuesday, October 1st, 5:15 p.m. at the Cathedral of the Blessed Sacrament. Everyone is invited. What made you decide, what'd you major in Davis?
I major in international relations and as a minor in Spanish.
What made you decide to go to law school? Did you go to law school right after you graduated?
Yes, uh-huh. So, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do after graduating. I needed a job, and I couldn't really get a job. It's right after college. But it was more of so my mom didn't really speak English. And because my brother is almost 10 years younger than I am, and my mom never remarried. I was the oldest son. I was the, the person in charge of the house. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was the spokesperson for the family. So early on in my life, I not only had to speak on behalf of my mom, but I had to speak on behalf of neighbors. And right. I really didn't have the personality, the skills, the desire to do all of that. But that was thrust on me. And I was recently told, it's kind of a funny story to some friends about how when you grow up in that, you think it's normal, but it's not. And you also feel uncomfortable and really intimidated, but you still do it. So besides speaking on behalf of my mother whenever she had a problem, I was the representative, like I said. My mom then would start volunteering me to neighbors. You know, mm-hmm. like, my son will fix this. He'll speak on you. Because they also didn't speak English, her friends. So I remember that a neighbor, her husband worked at the Southern Pacific. And I think he had an accident there and it killed him, mm-hmm. you know, related to work. I didn't understand it then, but he died there at work. So she received some compensation for that. And now that her husband was gone, she was thinking, well, okay, we're going to go back to Mexico. Her and her three daughters were going to go back to Mexico. And I thought, well, you know, I'm sorry to hear that because, you know, those are your friends that you have in this neighborhood. Well, anyway, so Mrs. Tellez, that was her name, she went and bought all new furniture, with the money she received, and then the sale of their small home, and she was going to go back to Mexico and relocate and raise her daughters there. And in fact, she did. Her family was there, you know, so. Anyway, so I remember her going to Brunner's mm-hmm. and buying a Zenith television. And, you know, Zenith was a television to have back then. And Brunner's was a store to buy.
Brunner's, for those who are newcomers, Brunner's was the department store for furniture.
So that's where she bought her furniture for. They were not wealthy, but this gave right. them that opportunity. So anyway, the television was malfunctioning. And she complained to my mom that how could a new television, a Zenith television coming from Brunner's, already have problems. And she didn't want to take this television back because in Mexico, who would know how to fix a television, right? So my mom said, I guess they had a conversation. Well, my son will fix it, right? Well, I'm not good at fixing anything. When it comes to my fixing skills, I'll pick up the phone and call somebody who knows what they're doing. Right. That's the extent of it, right? So anyway, my mom said, well, you know, what can you do? I said, well, I don't know what I can. I can't do anything. Well, somehow I got talked into going to Brunner's. The salesman who didn't want to have anything to do with me or that television, right. It was paid for. I guess they sent me to the manager's office. I walk into the manager's office and there's this old man sitting behind a desk with his arms crossed. Telling me that that's why we have warranties. We, you know, we'll fix the television, but we're not giving you a new television. Uh-huh. We're not. And what am I going to do with this television? Sell it as used? You know, I don't know. You know, it's this lady, and I guess I talked and talked and talked and talked and talked like I'm doing now. And so he said, okay, you know, finally. Like, I guess.
You wore him out.
Yeah, get out of my office, right? So I left. I must have been 15 or 16. And I was thinking, okay, whatever happens with this, I did what I was supposed to do. I pleased my mom. Hopefully our neighbor is happy. You know, I'm done. So they came to pick up the television. And they took it away. It was gone for a while. And then they brought another television. So I thought, well, maybe they fixed it. And this lady doesn't know. You know, how is she going to distinguish one television from the other? So she was very happy, the neighbor, and my mom was proud of me, what I had done. Okay. And I said to my mom, you know, I did what I could, but I don't know if really a new television, okay, because this person was not going to give her a new television. And he said, no, it was a new television. And I said, really? I said, how do you know? She said, because Mrs. Tellez made this mark on the the console leg.
Uh-huh.
And when that television came back, it wasn't there.
Oh, wow.
I said, pretty sneaky, huh? So I was the hero.
You're a hero. That's great. Mm-hmm. And you learned how to litigate.
I don't know if I learned how to litigate, but it was kind of awful putting a kid in that sort of situation. But yeah. It just had to be done. Yeah. You know, it had to be done.
So you went down to Loyola at Los mm-hmm. Angeles,
a
good Catholic school.
A good Catholic school, and, you know, I thought I had made it. It was intimidating because a number of my classmates, they had their whole life planned out. Some of them, their dads were judges. Some of them, their dads were partners, mm-hmm. Uncles. And so they weren't thinking in terms of graduating or passing the bar. They were thinking in terms of
where they're working,
yeah. how they were going to become judges also, and all the organizations they belong to. You know, I just wanted to get through. And I was doing my best to do so. And then in the first year of law school, my mom was diagnosed with cancer. Mm-hmm. So she was here in Sacramento, and my brother, who was 15 or 14 at the time, it was just both of them. And while I was going to Davis, I was really trying to live in two worlds. I was trying to be there during the week and mm-hmm. fit in, and it didn't really feel like I fit in very well. And then on weekends, coming home and trying to be responsible. Mm-hmm. That meant like cutting the lawn, trying to fix the car, being with my mom, all of those things that's what I grew up doing. So that's what I thought I needed to continue doing. And then, of course, eating my mom's delicious food. And then going back during the week, and at times eating food that was very different from what mm-hmm. I grew up with. I mean, that was the first place I tasted yogurt, the first place I had, and I didn't like alfalfa sprouts, you know, things like that that were just different.
I remember when alfalfa sprouts kind of became you couldn't get lettuce on a sandwich anymore. It was alfalfa sprouts,
right.
Especially in Davis.
Uh-huh.
And I have the same feeling about alfalfa sprouts.
I just, you know, all of this was new to me. And then it was disconcerting, too, that my classmates, they were going away for the weekend with their parents skiing. I've never been skiing. Or in the summer, they were planning on going with their parents or their extended family to Europe
right.
for the summer. And I was like, I'm not going to Europe in the summer. So you started thinking, well, there's something wrong with me, you know, because we got in here basically with good grades, but somehow I'm not part of all this, right? So it felt good to be at home on the mm-hmm. weekends. I felt like I fit here and I'm accepted. But obviously, during the time I was at Loyola, I had encountered some of that again, but in a different way, kind of at a higher level. But then I couldn't go home because, you know, my mom was here in Sacramento and I was in L.A., but I guess I was still trying to stay connected. But that was hard. I mean, ultimately, she passed away during my second year in law school from the cancer. I took a break from school. Came back. My brother went to live with guardians because, you know, he's going to become 16. The nucleus of my family was gone. Mm-hmm. Really what identified as this is who I belong to, this is who I am, was now no longer there. So then it was time to put my life together. And I'm grateful for my friends in law school. I'm eternally grateful to them. Because had it not been for them, I would not have gotten through my last year of law school.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I had to do, like a year and a half, almost 2 years, do it in 1 year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Kind of catch up. And they tutored me. They helped me research. They did all that. Because without that, plus I was fragmented. I was broken when I went back to law school.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Wow.
So that was it.
So you've been involved in a number of ministries.
Mm-hmm.
Catholic chaplain at California Youth Authority and IOWN, Sacramento Public Law Library, a joint program with Voluntary Legal Services of Northern California, the GAP program, God Answers Prayers, a gang awareness program with the Sacramento County Youth Detention, the Caros Prison Ministry at New Folsom Prison. Do you have a favorite ministry? And you've worked with Cristo Rey, of course.
You know, That's a very good question. Nobody has asked me that. I can tell you that I find commonality in all those ministries in this way. With kids, I see myself growing up and the challenges, and even more challenges for kids today. What pulls them away from an education, what leads them to a street and maybe get involved in gangs, what ultimately that is walking them toward prison. So I see that because since I go both to juvenile hall and to the prison, I see the patterns. The men at Folsom Prison, they're overwhelmingly either Hispanic or Black. The kids in juvenile hall are overwhelmingly Hispanic or Black. They have no center at home, especially for the Black kids. A lot of them don't know their dad, or their dads have been absent out of the homes or in prison or whatever. And the Hispanic kids, they then find this allegiance in the gangs. And I try to tell them, you know, there's a heavy price you're going to pay for this. The little money that you're getting, maybe the nice car and clothes, this means that you're either going to be spending some time or your life in prison, or your life's going to be cut short. So be very aware of the contract you're signing, because that's what you're signing yourself up for.
Right.
So to answer your question, so I like to go to ministries where, because of life circumstances, persons are now open, they're disposed to say, well, you know, I've done it my own way, but now I'm ready to at least look into what God's about. A downtime in their life or a low point in their lives. And then that's where I think where at least they're willing to hear, you know, like there's another way.
Right.
There is a God who's always been there, who has never walked away from you. You walked away, but never walked away from you, and who is still waiting for you, and who's ready to forgive us no matter what, and who loves us, and who loves you, and you're his child, and that will never change, and that dignity belongs to you, and no one else can take that away from you,
right.
And no one else can provide you with anything of close to that. So look at that. And hold on to that, because there's real value there. That's where I'd like to go.
Yeah, indeed, that's a great answer. I think we've all had those moments in our lives where we feel despair, and despair is one of those things that probably makes God unhappy, because it's if you're just in despair, you're sort of not trusting that God's gonna always be there for you. And I know with my
he's
own,
always there for us.
He's always there. And the one thing I hope that I give to my kids is that no matter how hard things get or situations you get yourself into, that God's there and he understands. And
undoubtedly.
You're his child and he loves you more than I do, which is hard to understand.
Yes.
But he does.
He does.
And, you know, I remember the prodigal son story.
Yeah.
I never quite liked it growing up as the younger brother in the family. And I just didn't quite understand it. The one kid ran off and did all this stuff and now
unfair.
Having a party. It was unfair. And then I had a son. And my whole view of the prodigal son story changed.
Yes.
You know, I understood about here comes the son back who'd fallen away, and you're greeting him with tears in your eyes.
Right. You're seeing him hurt.
Exactly.
And you're hurting more.
Exactly.
Because of their pain. And I'm sure God does that. Yeah. You know, it allows us very generously, magnanimously to exercise our free will. But I'm sure that God is hurting when he sees us in despair, when our poor decisions take us into such places of darkness and despair.
Yeah, I'll tell you, that free will stuff, as magnanimous as that may be, there are times when I say, why did you let me do that? Why did you give me free will? Why didn't you just give me the program and make me stay on it?
Yeah, there couldn't be love otherwise, I think, you know?
Yeah, indeed. Sergio, we could talk for a long time, and I sure hope we get you back on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. I hope I haven't talked.
Oh, no. It's been inspiring, and congratulations on I know you're very humble about it, but it's a well-deserved award, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the dinner on the 1st of October.
Thank you so much. Thanks again.
God bless. We'll take a quick break here. We'll be back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour.
Hi, this is Steve Patton, Associate Director for Family and Respect Life Ministries for the Diocese of Sacramento, and you are listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
That's me. Welcome back, and we're pleased to welcome in Lillian Clifford from St. Mary's Parish. Lillian, good day.
Good day. Thank you for having me.
Well, good to hear your voice again. You got big doings happening there.
Oh, yes. We invite everyone to our 88th annual St. Mary Festival celebration this Sunday.
Did you say 88th?
88th, that's right.
And that's older than
Sunday.
I am.
That's true.
My goodness.
Me too. It's from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. The address is 1333 58th Street, Sacramento, California.
I think we all know where your beautiful parish is, but that's great. On 58th Street?
Yes, we will have a car show, water slides, and many games for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
We will have pull tabs and cornhole, and don't ask me what that is. I guess it must be a game. And, yes, we will have bingo in the air-conditioned gym. We will also have a shopping mall for the ladies, as well as books, bargains, and boutiques. Our special raffle is a must. And most important, great food, choice for all tastes, and live music all day. What a bargain, huh?
Boy, that's this Sunday?
This Sunday, and it's free admission.
Wonderful.
And also, if people like the famous chicken dinner, that will be the Saturday before.
Oh, the evening. Saturday evening, right.
Yes, on August 17th from 6 to 9 p.m. Tickets must be purchased in advance. There will be no walk-ins. They are available on Bitly, St. Mary Raffle, and St. is ST. Also, people can buy, or actually, if they don't wish to go online, they can call the rectory at 916-452-0296. The prices will be $18 for adults, and the seniors and children are $10 each. So it'll be fun both evenings. The evening and the festival day.
And what time again does it start on Sunday?
Sunday is from 10 to 6.
Very good. Very good. After Mass.
After Mass. Right after Mass.
That's right. Very good.
It's going to be cool this week, so we're happy to have everybody over.
I was going to say that air-conditioned gym, you may have a lot of people paying bingo, but it's supposed to cool off this weekend. After we go through a real couple of days of torture.
Right.
Lillian, thanks so much for joining us, and I know you're going to have a great crowd out there at St. Mary's.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lillian. God bless. Bye-bye. That's St. Mary's with their 88th annual festival. That's mind-boggling. Camille Manantin joins us. Camille, good morning.
Morning.
Good to see you. We're talking about, I can't even pronounce it, quinoa.
When I first looked at it, I thought it said quinoa too. The Quininia Cup, so K-Cup.
The K-Cup. We'll just call it the K-Cup.
So K-Cup is basically a one-day event that's put on for young adults anywhere like from in our diocese to around our diocese. And it basically is a mix of competitive games where they compete to win the Quininia Cup, an actual trophy. And then we also do worship and adoration and benediction. And it kind of puts the worlds together between the fun and fellowship and the faith community that we have.
And is that a Greek word?
Yes. I don't know how to pronounce the Greek word, but the word translates to fellowship.
Right, right. And where is this all taking place?
So we're actually hosting it at St. John Vianney in Rancho Cordova.
And how is it run? Is it an athletic competition? Are we going to have races? We're going to have the three-legged sack race?
So it's actually a mix of different games. So there's usually some type of big one at the end. Can't give away too many of the surprises. But a lot of them are rotating games that we've done throughout the years. So the first K-Cup actually was in 2011. Mm-hmm. So we have an ongoing list of games. And then when teams register, they get a video and some instructions on what the games look like. And then they have like however long to practice. So when game day comes, they're able to compete and hopefully win.
Wow. So where are these teams coming from?
So we've had teams come from different parts of our diocese. We've had anywhere from different ministries like CBFL. We have Divine Mercy that competes. The different Newman Centers compete. And we also have had some from out of diocese, like Stockton Diocese. We've had Warriors for Christ out in Tracy. That's also come up. And it's just kind of nice to see everyone come together because there's so many young adult groups. But sometimes it feels like we're all spread out.
Right. What are the age range here?
So you have to be 18 mm-hmm. in order to play. So anywhere between 18 to 30, so in the young adult range.
Okay. So are many of these college students?
Yes. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are college students and recent graduates.
So what are the skills involved here?
So it can be anywhere between a lot of running. It's kind of a combination of like different mm-hmm. games. So it could be anywhere between running and a lot of just teamwork games that kind of not only forces them to recruit other people from their ministries to come together, but a lot of it is a lot of strategy games.
Really? So you have to be fast and you have to be smart.
Preferably, if you want to win.
And you have to be under 30. I don't think I can come.
But you could watch.
I could watch. Maybe I'd learn something.
Right. Strategize and coach the teams for next year.
Yeah. I'm pretty fast when I'm chasing my kids. But other than that, I'm not very fast.
I know. I think Every year I look at the games and I think, oh, I could totally do that.
Yeah.
And then I try to play it and I'm like,
Have you know, participated?
I have actually not participated. I practiced during the trial runs that we do. I did that 1 year. And usually I just watch the games and I try to think about how I would do it. And then I watch them do it, and then apparently my strategies don't work.
So is this like capture the flag, or what is it?
Usually we have about 6 games. So usually the one at our end is kind of like this big relay race. Mm-hmm. That it's like different little obstacles that we have to do. These games can do anything with like throwing or seeing like their accuracy for something. And yeah, there are a lot of games that we kind of pull from, like inspired from like different games. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a mix.
Men and women.
Yes, men mm-hmm. and women. Mm-hmm. And we kind of give them the creativity to figure out how they would do it. We don't give them too many tips. That way it kind of does give them that creativity to figure out how they would be able to compete and how to be able to win.
Do they have to be able to pronounce Koinonia?
I really hope not, because if not, if so...
Spell it for the K-O-I-N-O-N-I-A.
Yes.
I'd like to buy a vowel, Vanna.
I know, it has almost every vowel in there.
I think you want to buy a consonant.
Honestly, it's probably why for a really long time I just called it K-Cup. I couldn't figure out how to pronounce it for a really long time. I would wait for other people to say it.
Well, K-O-I-N has got to be coin. O-N-I, Koinonia. Koinonia. It's got to be.
It just sounds really fancy.
It does. It sounds kind of elegant.
It does. Yeah. And then K-Cup is like, oh.
What does the K-Cup look like? Is it like a big trophy? Is it like winning Wimbledon or something?
It's an actual trophy. When I first heard of it, I thought it was like just like a picture. Mm-hmm. But no, it's an actual trophy. It has like a little wooden base, this big silver trophy that gets goes from one winner to the next.
So is there a religious element to this?
Yes. So we actually...
Besides people praying for victory, but I mean, other than that, is there a religious element here?
Yeah. So we actually start the day off with Mass.
Okay.
And...
That's a good idea. Good way to start the day.
Right? Pray for all the blessings.
Right.
And we have Mass, and then we go into some fellowship, and then we have the games. So everything's done in different blocks. And then we also have a little bit of praise and worship that goes on as well. And then we also have adoration and benediction. Mm-hmm. And then the whole idea of it is, yes, it's like the games, the competition that brings people together. But it's also going down to the root that we're all here, part of this bigger community.
Right.
And seeing everyone come together for those things is always really beautiful. Because you don't always think about, like, oh, is this other group doing this? It's kind of see everyone together.
Wow. Wouldn't it be great if they did all the Mass and benediction and all that before the Super Bowl? For the players.
You know, Maybe they'd be able to win a little bit more and less injuries.
Yeah. Vince Lombardi, the legendary coach of the Green Bay Packers, he held Mass right at the stadium for his players on Sunday morning.
Oh, really?
Because the games are on Sunday in the NFL. And so he had Mass right there.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I like
probably
that a lot.
Why they won all the time.
So, all these teams are going to Mass, and yet there's only one winner.
There's only one winner. We haven't figured that one out yet. They're both praying to God for victory.
It's like, who's going to sing
what
the loudest?
What does God do? What can he do? You guys, you're putting me in a tough spot here. Yeah.
It's like, I just kind of roll the dice and there you go.
So how do people sign up for this?
So you can actually go online. So if you go to our website, koinoniacup.org, it'll lead you right now to our Google form. Yep. And you actually don't need a lot to register. You actually just need a captain and a co-captain, as well as their contact information. So a phone number and an email, and then also just like a team name.
And when is it?
It's going to be October 12th.
Okay. And so how soon do you want them to sign up? Right away, huh?
Yes. So we have early bird pricing going on right now. We just extended it until the end of August. So August 31st, 11:59. That'll be the end of our early bird pricing. It's actually 50% off our team fees. So instead of the regular $50, it's only $25. And bargain. Then it's $5 per player.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Very good. Camille, always good to see you. We'll look forward to seeing you again.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks so much. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy Ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Ministry of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and long-standing support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.
Hey, this is Chris Owens. I'm the Director of the Office of Family and Faith Formation for the Diocese of Sacramento, and you're listening to The Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.